And good afternoon. I'm Jimmy Buff. Peter Buffett with us in the studio this afternoon. How are you doing, Mr. Buffett?
I'm good, thank you.
I find it amazing that we started airing audio chapters from Surviving the Future probably in September is when I think. Yeah, it was early September when we aired the introduction chapters. Here we are with just three chapters left.
Well, all right. You could have read it faster, anyone out there listening, but this is one way to take it all in, and I think that's pretty great.
Surviving the Future is subtitled Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. It's edited by Sean Chamberlain from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic. And yes, we could have read it faster. Wouldn't have been as much fun for me.
Most definitely not. Me neither.
And people can actually hear the audio chapters in whatever order they'd like to because they're all archived at RadioKingston.org.
That's pretty great.
But here we are at Chapter 14, and this is called The Wheel of Life.
Chapter 14, The Wheel of Life. The Wheel of Life is a way of thinking about the life cycle of a complex system that explains the seemingly inevitable cycles of boom and bust. Complex living systems, whether woodlands, companies, civilizations, or our planet Gaia herself, can be understood as inhabiting the space defined by two variables or dimensions. First, potential. A measure of the richness of the system, in the sense of being able to make interesting things happen. The quantity and diversity of plant and animal life in an ecosystem, the friendships, trust, and social capital sustained in a society, the skills and accomplishments of a culture. And secondly, connectedness, the extent and strength of the linkages between different parts of the system, which influence or govern how they respond to events. As you can imagine, potential and connectedness relate positively to each other. The more connected the system is, the greater its potential, and greater potential opens the way to more fully developed connections. But there are limits to this progress. As a system's potential grows, so does the cost of keeping the whole thing going. For instance, it needs more inputs, it produces more waste, and it becomes a more tempting prey for enemies. And as connectedness grows, the system eventually starts to become less flexible, slower to respond, less locally inventive, more tightly coupled. There is now the risk that, when trouble occurs, it will ripple through the whole system. The pioneers of resilience thinking, C.S. Hollis, Lance Gunderson and colleagues, put all this together for us in a story about four phases in the life or adaptive cycle of a system. Phase 1. Exploitation. This is where early entrants make use of the wealth of opportunity in their environment to multiply. Most fail, not least because they are poorly connected individuals facing a dangerous world on their own, but some may eventually build a system with potential and connectedness. An example of this exploitation phase would be young pioneer tree saplings on waste ground. This is known as the R phase, since R has for many years been used as a label for the rate of growth of the population of an ecology. Phase 2 is conservation. An example of a system in this phase would be mature trees. Here the system persists in its mature form, with the benefit of a complex structure of connections, strong enough now to resist challenges for a long time, but with the weakness that the connections themselves introduce an element of rigidity, slowing down its reactions and reducing its inventiveness. This is known as the K phase, where the ecology reaches its carrying capacity. In due course, however, the tight connections themselves become a decisive problem, which can only be resolved by phase 3, release. At this point, the cost and complication of maintaining the large scale, providing the resources the system needs and disposing of its waste becomes too great. The space and flexibility for local responsiveness had become scarce, the system itself so tightly connected that it locked, a target for predators without and within, against which it found it harder and harder to defend itself. But now the stresses join up and the system collapses. The example here is a dying tree. Holling and Gunderson call this the Omega phase, and here it is placed by them in its ecological context. The tightly bound accumulation of biomass and nutrients becomes increasingly fragile, overconnected in systems terms, until it is suddenly released by agents such as forest fires, droughts, insect pests, or intense pulses of grazing. The resources sequestered in vegetation and soil are suddenly released, and the tight organization is lost, so that the potential for other uses re-emerges. Hence phase four, reorganization. At this point, the remains of a system after collapse are unpromising material on which to start afresh, and yet they are an opportunity for a different kind of system to enjoy a brief flowering, decomposing the wood of a former forest, recycling the carbon after a fire, restoring the land with forgiving grass, clearing away the assumptions and grandeur of the previous regime. Reorganization becomes a busy system in its own right, for example, a rotting tree. This is known as the alpha phase. In this phase, there is a persistent process of disconnecting, with the former subsidiary parts of the system being broken up. But we can note a curious aspect of this phase. Whereas in the first two phases, more potential is correlated with more connectedness, here that relationship is reversed. Reduced connectedness goes with more potential. How can this be? Well, potential can be the product of sharply developed, well-connected structures. In the confident prime of life of Rome, with its army, its institutions, its transport networks and its wealth, who could tell what astonishing things they might produce? That is, high connectedness sometimes brings high potential. However, potential is also the product of a system which is starting all over again. Where a forest has just burned, not much can grow there. But soon the charred tree trunks rot down. The land is weak on charisma, strong on potential. Grass and flowers flourish. It is now ready for anything. That is, low connectedness sometimes brings high potential. For example, it takes an exceptionally hardy plant to be among the first to colonize a sand dune. Salt, flood, drought, almost no nutrients in the soil, and no surrounding plants to protect it or to cooperate. Limegrass has made a speciality of surviving these conditions. It tolerates salt. Its leaves have a waxy coating to conserve water. It binds the sand and traps it as it blows. But in due course, the sand smothers it, and marram grass takes over. It too gets buried by the sand, but it can grow through it, and its roots bind the sand at a deep level, providing stability for more plants, such as sand sedge, sea holly, sea bindweed, sea spurge, and Portland spurge. The spurges contain a white latex, which makes them taste unpleasant to rabbits. Then come plants seeded by the wind, such as dandelions, groundsels, thistles, hawkbits, hawkweeds, hawkbeards, and ragworts, which, along with grass grazed by the rabbits, form a short, tight turf, fertilized by the rabbit droppings. Next come lichens and mosses, followed by wild thyme, then grasshoppers, caterpillars, bees, and spiders, and their predators, including mice, voles, skylarks, and kestrels. Now there is enough soil for bushes, such as hawthorn, elder, and brambles, followed by creeping willow and orchids. Eventually, trees will dominate, and, unless something happens to break the succession, the area will mature into woodland. These four sequential stages, then, take us through the life cycle of any system, and show us two periods during which systems are particularly resilient to shocks. One of these is in the later stages of phase one, exploitation, when the system's potential and connectedness are both well developed, but before the rigidities of maturity have set in. The other is in phase four, the reorganization phase, when the remains of complex structures are broken down into a form that can be used in the next phase. Since there is not much structure and connectedness here in the first place, little damage can be done, even by large shocks. What has all this got to do with us? It is in the first of these two resilient stages, where a functioning, complex system has a lot to lose and needs all the resilience it can get, which is the stage that matters urgently to our society, now. The point where we now stand, however, is the one near the later stages of conservation, the K phase in which a mature, tightly connected tree lives. What is in prospect is the next stage in the cycle, release, where our tree falls to the ground, with the further prospect of breakup and reorganization into a different system, into an utterly different world. It is not unreasonable for us to want to postpone this development. Nor is it unreasonable to consider whether there is a way of going with the flow, that is, doing the right things in a systems literate way to somehow extend the life of the cycle that really matters to us, the one we happen to be on. Can this be done? Well, to answer this, let us first unpack the cycle a bit. It is helpful, in fact, to identify six stages in the cycle. Again, we start with exploitation or renewal. Here we have the phase of pioneers, working by trial and error, evolving as organisms and raising their productivity, but in most cases failing to get very far because they lack connectedness. They are not embedded in rich ecosystems which protect them, join them up in alliances and reciprocities, and extend the length of their natural life cycle from days to years. Nevertheless, some do survive and begin to join up with others into a system. Secondly, reconnection and growth. This is the system's glad, confident morning. It forges connections and grows in size and complexity. Complex organisms inhabit it. There is a chain of stimulus and inspiration between one success and the next, and it becomes resilient, able to duck and weave, to recover in response to stresses. Then comes conservation or consolidation. The system now extends, elaborates, and reinforces its connections. In the case of a civic society, there is intensification as the intermediate economy develops, with its huge commitments which nobody wants for their own sake, but which are a necessary support structure for the large scale. There is also growing regulation imposed in support of the institutions which emerge as civic society becomes less diverse, requiring more coordination from the centre. There is consolidation. Nothing or nothing significant can move without a lot of other things having to move at the same time. Problems spread at speed. There is top-down control, a loss of flexibility and imagination, a loss of resilience. And, perversely, the conventional responses to this phase seem to be devoted to the cause of making the system, in its hour of need, even less resilient. As the systems scientists Brian Walker and David Salt note, solutions are sought in standardization and efficiency improvements, in increasingly centralized command and control, and in tighter insistence on process, rules, and procedures. That is, in stamping out any new vision, experiment, and self-reliance, and in further elaborating expensive procedures standing in the way of getting things done. The problem is the large scale, rigidity, and complication. The solution is seen as even larger scale, greater rigidity, and further complication, a classic case of the amplifying feedback typical of a complicated system in trouble. Fortunately, these mainstream solutions do not attract a consensus. There are some harmless lunatics who think differently. Yet this is the stage where we are now. We may wonder what lies ahead and consider radical responses. Stage four, of course, is release. The more rigid the system becomes in trying to postpone the shock, and the longer it is postponed, the more catastrophic it will eventually be. The system's potential falls away. Inflexible and complicated, it cannot defend itself. The big intermediate structures, still intact but not functioning, are a burden on the system, hastening its collapse. Stage five, breakup. Now the connected system degenerates. Its productivity falls to zero. And stage six, reorganization. This is the compost stage. The remains of the system's connected structure finally rot down, perhaps becoming rich with potential to eventually regenerate into a new system. Is the sequence inevitable? To answer this, we need to think about time and about the networks of parts that make up any system. If these parts, systems within systems, also known as holons, each complete and functional in their own right, are to be useful to the larger system, they will vary in size. They will do different things in different ways. They will have the freedom to experiment, to repair and recover, to adapt and evolve. In a healthy system, each part or holon is able to operate at its own pace, according to its own clock. It is protected from above by the larger, slower-moving system to which it belongs. It is stimulated by and responds to the smaller, faster, shorter cycles of innovation and response of the holons lower down. Local communities, for example, are holons within the wider system of society. Whole systems thinking is an undoubted virtue, but it must at the same time recognize the distinctive properties and needs of the parts. Systems thinking depends as a first step on seeing the robust, semi-independent, small-scale competence that is distributed through a complex system, and on having a name for it. Here is an example of the faster reaction times of a subsystem relative to the large, slow-moving system to which it belongs. Tropical forests have evolved such a thick canopy of leaves that it is hard for seedlings on the ground to get enough light to survive. The seed holon has, therefore, comparatively recently, evolved a response in the form of very large seeds. These contain enough nutrients for the seed to grow despite being deprived of light and nibbled at by curious animals like tapirs, which eat the surrounding fruit and in the process spread the seeds around. The earlier seeding systems, which depended on abundant light, died and gave way to systems that could cope with the deep gloom of the forest floor. This life and death flexibility, the rapid regeneration response of the subsystem, enables the large system, the forest, to go on and on. Another example of a subsystem, a village, can be flexible in its own life, economy, and society. In place of the sophisticated preoccupations of the city, it may be able to hang on to the realities of life and nature, even if urban civic society cannot. Subsystems can come and go, adapt quickly, or die and reinvent themselves. They can go with the flow of trial and error, life and death. These are the strategies of recovery, elastic resilience, the ability to bounce back. The subsystem has greater flexibility to quickly explore these strategies because, in addition to the large relative surface area enjoyed by small-scale systems, it is operating on a shorter life cycle than the overall system. And when repeated many times by many parts of the system, this series of small-scale new beginnings can provide a community, ecosystem, or civilization with constantly renewing resilience. The more flexible its subsystems, the longer the expected life of the system as a whole. Such recovery elastic resilience depends on the system's holons, subsystems, or communities having four key properties. They must have substantial independence, weak interdependence, and self-reliance, so that the system as a whole is modular. They must develop characteristics and behavior in response to local conditions. Some of those responses will be unsuccessful and death will follow, but the variety makes it likely that other responses by other holons will do better. This gives the system as a whole diversity. It follows in turn that there must be some slack in the holons, capable of being brought into play when needed, and allowing damage to be sustained at the periphery without destroying the core. And there will need to be alert feedback. That is, the parts must be able to observe and respond quickly to events, not waiting for reassurance or permission from the center. A system which has this resilience, enabling its local subsystems to go into shock and live out their life cycles on timescales shorter than that of the larger system, has a chance of enduring, of attaching an achievable meaning to the wheel of life. In other words, what we have here, in principle, is a way of extending the life of a large-scale system indefinitely by enabling the ravages of time the whole life cycle from birth to death to birth, to take place with respect to the system's parts or holons. The system as a whole is thereby constantly renewed. There is a general rule here. Large-scale problems do not require large-scale solutions. They require small-scale solutions within this kind of large-scale framework. And that is precisely what happens in every living creature. All its parts are in a constant state of recovery, elastic resilience, extending the life of their host system, if not indefinitely, at least for much longer than their own lives. The problem with the large-scale civic society is that the cost of connecting itself up is a rigidity which stops a critical part of this process, the delegation of life and death, sacrifice and succession, in its tracks. Condemning the society as a whole to lumber into the death stage, big time. Independent local lean economies are a means of restoring the system's immortality, or at least its longevity. But whether they actually succeed in doing this depends on how independent they are, how local, how alert, how quick, how diverse and how flexible. It may be too late to achieve a rapid transition into the de-intensified structure of self-reliant independent groups, which is the foundation for resilience. It is not too late to try.
And that is chapter 14 from Surviving the Future, a chapter entitled The Wheel of Life. Peter Buffett in the studio with us this afternoon. What I'm struck by is just how perfectly this chapter and the book at large describes where we are right now.
I know. And actually listening to this chapter for a second there towards the end, I was hopeful for the country. I thought, oh, wait, things are collapsing. Maybe the larger system can stay in place if that happens. But no, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. There was a phrase in early on in the chapter, the prime of life of Rome, mm-hmm. which we could substitute
right.
America, the prime of life
right.
of America
yep.
there.
Yep.
And the nostalgia for that, which is...
Right. Make America great again.
Make America
right.
great again, right?
Right.
But that robust prime of life, of course, which wasn't equitable to all,
right.
Is fading in the rear view. And
yep.
we're in this place now of this mature tree, as he pointed, I think was the example,
yeah. Yeah.
That is getting ready for what's next.
Yeah, and, I also was struck by, as you know, I'm a fan of American history and the Civil War and Reconstruction, and I'm reading another book about it, and I had never realized, I've used this phrase before, that before the Civil War, people said the United States are, and after the Civil War, they said the United States is. So we began as a collection of smaller units that had enough independence to kind of create their own destiny, for lack of a better word. And yet in the South, there was a real, there's a civil war going inside of the Civil War because the small subsistence farmers didn't really want to get into it. And it was the planter class with slaves, of course, that had the money, first of all, to not actually get conscripted into it, and also fought for their independence, while the independent people, in Kentucky and Tennessee and Virginia, were saying, we don't want this. We're fine. Thank you.
And that amazingly plays out time and time and time again
right.
in our history, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. But so many things that have resulted in this superstructure of the federal government over us happened then. And if somehow something different could have happened right around then, we might still be more individual states being able to kind of pursue our own identity.
Yeah. And that points up something that you talk about frequently is scale, right?
Right.
Here
oh,
we are at yeah. this size and, that we take this thing as a whole,
right.
this United States thing as a whole,
yep.
when so many issues and challenges are localized.
Absolutely. And there's this kind of mythology and truth around consolidation leading to efficiency, which, of course, in a capitalist market, profit-driven frame, it makes sense. And so again, the federal government keeps consolidating power, and then it loses contact with what's actually going on.
Yeah, and that point was underscored in this chapter with the idea that some people think that then we just need more efficiency on top of that.
Right, exactly. which leads to that thing I say all the time about the abstract and the particular. I mean, if things are an abstraction, if you're sitting in Washington making decisions, I mean, the shutdown right now is an example. The individual stories are heartbreaking. And yet those, you know, rarely rise to the surface, or if they do, they're considered biased because they're being told by one person versus another. I mean, the level of breakdown is extraordinary.
The idea put forth in this chapter too, that the remains of a system after collapse are not the prime conditions for things to be good.
Right.
But they offer opportunities.
But they offer opportunities. And I think that's why we look to places like Detroit and Jackson and Baltimore and places where things have collapsed, because that's where people are taking the opportunity and they're doing things differently.
Yeah. It's been a remarkable journey through Surviving the Future. We've got just two short chapters left. Maybe we'll combine them next week.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And chapter 15 is titled Transition.
Well, all right.
Which is, where we think we find ourselves here in early 2019, particularly in this city of Kingston.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people do, or a lot of people wish they could feel that way. That gets back to slack. You know, so many people don't have the opportunity to think what, or imagine really, you know, what could be next? How could I be a part of that? I want to help.
Yeah. Outstanding. Peter Buffett, thank you again for stopping in this Tuesday afternoon.
Always. Thanks for having me.
Always. And we will see you next Tuesday afternoon.
All right.